science story.
He's NYU scientist.
I felt right.
I was so
and I just thought, well,
I figured it out.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true personal stories about science. I am your host, Aaron Barker, and this week we're presenting stories about secrets. Those things that we're afraid to share, that we keep hidden. But before we get started, I just want to quickly thank the whole Story Collider team for coming out to Ossining, New York last weekend for our annual producers retreat. They came from all over the world, whether it was California, Seattle, Atlanta, Canada, the UK, or even New Zealand. And we spent an amazing 2 days at the Bethany Arts Center up in Ossining, about an hour outside of New York City. Each night, we held storytelling shows in their beautiful chapel space, including, on Saturday night, our fancy dress party. There may or may not be videos on the internet of me dancing to Lizzo in a dolphin costume. I can neither confirm nor deny. That's my own secret shame to deal with. We ended the night hanging out around Bethany Arts Center's fire pit out back, and I cannot tell you how magical it was. If you're looking for a destination for your upcoming creative retreat, go to bethanyarts.org and find out more. But for now, without any further ado, here are the two wonderful stories that we have to share with you today. Our first story is from Jen Montooth. It was recorded in June 2019 at Beer Baron in Washington, D.C., The theme that night was tipping points.
I am an adult. I am saying this to my 22-year-old self over and over as I'm looking down at my graduate school acceptance letter. And I'm like, I am finally on the right track. I am on a track, at least. It's better than none. This is going to be the first time in my life where I'm no longer a barista, where the steam milk is constantly burning my hands. For once, I don't have to work 3 or 4 jobs in college just to pay for college. I am going to be a scholar, a historian, if you will. And then I'm going to get a real job. And then I'm going to come home at the end of the day and drink a glass of wine. That's right, out of a glass. Not a plastic LeBron James cup with a hologram of him doing a slam dunk. We'll have real cups in my house. So for days after this, I'm sitting with this excitement and wonder about what adulthood is going to look at. I'm 22, I'm not 15, but... But I also notice while I'm super excited, I am exhausted, and I'm nauseous, and my breasts are swollen. When is the last time I had my period? I can't remember, so that's a bad sign. This is pre-tracking app, so I don't know. But you know what? It doesn't matter, because I'm an adult now, remember? I'm very responsible. So I'm just gonna go to the grocery store and get a pregnancy test. Bing, bam, boom. I get to the grocery store and I'm like, you know what? I'm already here. Let me just go get that negative so that I can go to the thrift store afterwards and enjoy the rest of my day. So I'm sitting in the bathroom and that pink circle starts to slowly fill up and I see a horizontal line, negative. And I'm like, oh, yes, Jen, you paranoid idiot. Of course you weren't pregnant. And I look back down and now that I see there is a vertical line on top of the horizontal line, positive, which is great for a GPA, but bad if you do not want to be pregnant. And I was like, no. How could this happen to me? I don't get laid. I'm a student. I don't just go parranting around. This is the first guy I hooked up with in a year, and look how it turned out. He was some random guy I met at a party, and then he wanted me to come over and watch Bad Boys 2. Naive me, I thought that's what he wanted to do. I was pretty disappointed when that wasn't the case. But here we are. So, for some reason, it's frowned upon to stay in the Safeway bathroom forever, so I have to leave, right? And the bathroom is on the other side of the store, so I'm all the way in the back, and I have to walk through. And I'm paranoid that somehow everyone in the grocery store knows I'm pregnant, and I'm also scared that they somehow think I stole the pregnancy test. I'm just, like, waiting for someone to point at me and go, like, we got a pregnant robber over here. Somebody get... Or, like, hiding their kids from me. So, you know, all this newly found maturity I had gained as an adult has quickly dissipated. And now I am desperate for reassurance. And within a few hours, I tell, like, everyone I knew I was pregnant. Horrible idea. Never do that. And, you know, I should point out that I pretty much knew right away that I did not want a kid. I'm 22, I'm broke, this is the last thing I want. I want to go to school. But I'm also terrified, so I'm kind of hoping for reassurance from my loved ones. I'm hoping they'll say something like, you know what, just make the decision that's best for you, you're going to be fine. But that's not the case, unfortunately. My best friend from high school was like, what are you going to do? You know I'm like against abortion, right? And my family was like, oh, abortion, that doesn't sound like you. Maybe you should think about adoption. And the guy that got me pregnant called me in 5-minute intervals, and he was like, hey, Tim again, just want to make sure you're getting that abortion. Just so you know, it's the only way I'm going to support you. Prince Charming, I think he's single, ladies, if you're interested. Why am I not with him right now? And my boss at the time at the coffee shop was like, Jen, you are going to be a great mom. Just like work really hard and save your money, which first of all, ew. No, thank you. And then I no, it's so gross. And, you know, I thought about my situation at the time. I'm a barista, so I don't have money. And I'm living with a bunch of male roommates who are not exactly frat guys, but they're definitely the type of guys that, like, barge in your room on a Tuesday night, and they're like, take a shot with us, you coward! Like, stop doing your homework! One of them could only fall asleep if he was in the living room sleeping on the couch listening to Mad Max at full volume. I could quote that entire movie to you right now, and it's not by choice. So their reaction when I told them when I was pregnant was to look at each other and go, house baby! I know. I know. I was like, no! Absolutely not! So, you know... as the shock is wearing off of all this, all of these random voices just coming at my face is very overwhelming. At this point in my life, no one is supporting me, and also I don't know anyone that's had an abortion, so I feel entirely alone at this point. And the only way I can get through it is each night I would go into my car, and I would either drive or I would just sit there in my driveway and I would play a Simon and Garfunkel CD in my car and just cry. And this was probably, I was only pregnant about a week, but when I look back, it just feels like this long time, just this haze. And, you know, even though it sounds really sad, like it felt so good to cry. You know, I was in shock, so I really wanted that emotion. And I would always listen to that CD when I was PMS and needed to cry, so it kind of felt like I was training up for this moment in my whole life, you know? And there was this particular lyric in Kathy's song, don't know if any of you know it, where they say, like, the only truth I know is you. And that part always got me, like, in between sobs. I was like, you're right, Paul Simon, I only know myself. You're so right. But that made me realize that I already knew what I wanted to do. I was just really scared, but, you know, even though I was alone in this, that meant I had to take care of it alone. So I decided eventually that I was going to stop crying, and I was going to replace that Simon and Garfunkel CD with the self-titled Genesis album, and I was going to go get that fucking abortion. Go ahead and clap. You're fucking right, I got that abortion. And, you know, of course, after that, it was really hard because everyone in my life was still judgmental. So I had to lie to a lot of people and say I got a miscarriage so that I didn't have to deal with their judgments. And everyone else also made me feel really guilty about my decision. So even though I was relieved, I felt really guilty about it. And it took me about 2 years to get over that guilt and realize that it was totally fine. But it happened in one night. My friend came into town, and I knew that she was accepting, and I just kind of had a feeling that she was going to take it well. So I asked her to go for a walk with me in the dark so that I didn't have to face her. It was pretty much just shouting it out into the night. She said I had an abortion. And her response was like, oh, yeah, I had two a few years back. My boyfriend was an asshole. And I was like, what? She's like, yeah, it's fine. And I was like, yes, I am fine. And I do not have to feel ashamed about it. In fact, I feel great. And it was so healing. And I hope I can do that for other people. Thank you so much.
That was Jen Montooth. Jen is a public historian for the National Human Genome Research Institute, where she helps with the public's understanding of genomics and captures the history of the Human Genome Project. She received her master's in public history from UMBC, where she focused on the Black Power movement. Jen is the executive producer of the live storytelling show Health's Angels, personal stories about women's health, where women can share their mental, physical, and emotional health stories. Jen, I love that show title. Our next story today is from Anna Miller. It was recorded in June 2019 at the Dandy at Midventris Modern in Milwaukee. This was the launch of our Milwaukee Home Stage show, and you can catch us there again on October 17th.
Speaking of my mom, when I was little, I thought that science was magic. So my mom used to say that as soon as you could walk, you could wonder. And I would ask her questions like, Mom, why is the moon made out of cheese? To which my professor of a mother would respond, actually, it's made out of elements like magnesium and aluminum. How do we know that, Mom? Well, the scientists built a big metal bird, and they flew it up into the sky, and they took pieces of the moon into their hands, and they brought them back down to Earth, so that I could tell you what's in them. Science is magic, right? And Mom, why do I have to take medicine? This medicine is called an antibiotic, right? It's penicillin. It will help you feel better. How do you know, Mom? Well, the scientists discovered it hiding in mold, and they took these little soldiers and they crushed them up in their hands and they made pills that once you put in your body, will fight for you. Science is magic, right? And Mom, why does Dad drink all the time? I don't know. Does anybody know? Do the scientists know? Nobody knows, right? So I'm 7 years old, and I'm wondering. So I go straight to the source. My dad, when he drank, he would drink Svedka straight out of the bottle. And he would sit at the kitchen table and sit just quietly by the window, and he would just drink his Svedka, and he would just stare at the space between atoms. And I remember asking him about it. The only time I think I ever directly asked him about it, 7 years old, I walked up to him and I said, Dad, does it taste that good? And he didn't even look at me. He just stared at the space between atoms. And he just said, go to your room, sweetie. And so that night, I went into the cabinet where my mom kept the household cleaning supplies and the Mr. Yuck stickers that she would stick diligently onto everything we were not supposed to drink. This is not juice. And I took all the Mr. Yuck stickers and I covered his Svedka bottle in them. And he still finished the bottle. Why, right? I think growing up in that house, we all wondered why. and wondering why became a part of me, just as I'm sure it was a part of him. By the time I was old enough to drink, and by this I don't mean legally, I mean old enough to figure out how to get alcohol, it was Thanksgiving, I was in middle school, and my parents had all this dinner wine. My dad would drink an entire bottle of Svedka, but this much dinner wine, why, right? And so I stole the dinner wine, and I drank a lot of it, and it burned going down, and it burned coming back up, and it was, ugh. But I do remember this feeling of release, right? This feeling of release from tension, this place where you forget things, where things aren't the way they used to be. I remember that. And nobody ever found out, or if they did, they didn't say anything. As I got older, and I started exploring more, now I'm in high school, I started to get my hands on things that weren't alcohol, drugs, right? So I grew up in a small Wisconsin town, and there's really not that much to do if you're in high school, except for drugs, at least for somebody like me, who stands out. Somebody who's terrible at sports and really good at art and really good at music and likes to skateboard, but doesn't really fit in. So here I am in high school, doing drugs. Somehow I'm still in all the honors classes, AP English, and just really skating by on my smarts, passing my tests, not doing any of my homework. And it starts to get worse and worse and worse, and by the time I graduate, I need to go to rehab. I didn't go voluntarily. My mom locked me in the car and she drove me to rehab. And the rehab she took me to is the rehab my father was staying at. At this point, he was in and out of rehab all the time. He had lost his family, he had lost his friends, he had lost his job, he had lost himself, he'd lost his mind. And I remember pounding on the windows of the car as we were on our way to the rehab. And when we got there and I saw my dad walk down the stairs, I recognized that look, right? He was staring at me, but he wasn't looking at me. He was looking at the space between atoms. And my mom threw my suitcase out onto the ground and my dad picked it up and I followed him up the stairs to his room, which was full of bunk beds full of people just like him. But there wasn't a bunk bed for me because everything was full, so they roll in a hospital cot and I'm sitting there with my suitcase. I have no idea what's in it. I've been up for days and we're just sitting there quietly. And he asked me, he said, if you could leave right now, what would you do? And I said, I would get high. And he said, well, you're not leaving until that answer changes. And so I made it about 3 days. There were all of these older men in there, and some of them talked way too much, and some of them didn't talk at all. And by the end of those 3 days, I realized that if I continued down the path I was on, I would also end up with my own bunk bed. So I called my mom, I went home, and I tried to start over. Like I said, I had been skating by on my smarts, so I was passing all my tests, so I had a good enough GPA, and I had good enough ACT score to get into college. And my mom, being a professor, she kind of helped me slide under the door, and I got into our local four-year college, University of Wisconsin River Falls. So I get into college, I sign up for all my classes, I start going to all the freshman orientations, and I meet all the wrong people immediately. Start going to parties, I'm like, this is awesome. So great, so many people like me. The problem was everyone was like me, right? So I'm drinking, I'm not going to class, I relapse, and I stop going to college. I cut off my family, and I'm living in an attic with some other artists, and I'm just doing drugs all the time. And I think at this point, I'm 19 years old, and I didn't really realize how bad it was getting because everyone around me was acting like everything was fine, right? Until this one day I looked in the mirror, and I'm not proud of this, but the truth is, you know, being young, being pretty, I could talk my way into getting a lot of free drugs, a lot of free stuff. But at this point, I remember looking in the mirror and I could see the outlines of the bones in my cheeks, and I was no longer pretty. My hair was falling out. My eyes were just too big for my face. And I couldn't stand up straight because I had pneumonia, which I couldn't feel because I was doing drugs. I wasn't eating, I wasn't sleeping, and I was falling apart. And I looked in the mirror and I saw the space between atoms. So I called my mom. Like the prodigal son returning home, I packed anything that I owned, which wasn't much, into garbage bags, and I begged her to take me back. And she said, I'll take you back if you go to college. At this point, I'm really sick. So it takes me a few months to recover, but I do go back to college. And I cut everybody off. I say, all right, you know what? I got close again this time, but not again. This time, I got this. I'm gonna cut everybody off. I'm gonna start over. But I have no friends. I have nothing to do. So I just do my homework. And it takes me about a month before I realize the wonder is still there. And college is the best place in the entire world because nobody's telling you, hey, we're cutting funding to the art program. Hey, we're cutting funding to the foreign language program and giving it to the football kids again. Now I can take French film. I can take psychology. I can take art history classes. I can take epigenetics. I can take neuroscience. Anything I've ever wondered about right there at my fingertips. And I'm a minority, so I get half my school paid for. I didn't realize at the time how important neuroscience would become to me, but neuroscience over the next few years became my life. Neuroscience is the study of the biological manifestation of behavior. So where psychology is talked about more as a soft science, neuroscience tries to find the cellular basis of behavior and of disease. It's fascinating. And it's mysterious. We really don't know that much about the brain. And this was so tempting to me. I would ask my professor why, and they would say, well, we don't know. Scientists haven't figured that out yet. Wow, magic, right? Something incomprehensible. And I said, I want that to be me. I want to be a scientist. How do I do that? So I started asking questions, and then before I knew it, the only neuroscientist at our school gave me the chance to do research with him. And what did I want to do research on? Addiction. Luckily, he had some experience doing this type of research. So we did research on nicotine addiction using an animal model of self-administration, where an animal will press a lever and receive an injection through a catheter of nicotine. Because, you know, a rat can't really hold a cigarette. And what we found was that when we chronically stressed our rats, obviously all according to protocol, and then gave them the chance to self-administer nicotine, even if they hadn't touched it for months, with stress, they'd go right back to it. Fascinating, right? And you could find the biological differences based on how much stress hormone was flowing through the rat at the time, therefore, and how much nicotine. It was all malleable, fascinating, right? Breaking down this mystery into data. And before I knew it, I was president of the Honor Society. I was presenting my research at Berkeley. I was presenting my research at the Society for Neuroscience, and I was applying to grad school. I applied to 30 different programs. The acceptance rate's 2%, and I got into 3 of them. So now I'm flying across the country, meeting all these professors, you know, who I used to be, but a shadow in the past, you know. I am now the top of my class. I'm that girl in the front row with her hand up that everyone rolls their eyes about. So I get into grad school here in Milwaukee at Marquette. I get a full ride to get my doctorate, $100,000. Coming from an immigrant family, this is, oh, you've made it. A doctor. Nice. Whew, thought you were going to be an artist for a sec there. So I get into grad school, and I am just elated, right? Because who I was, that girl looking in the mirror, nothing but a memory in the past. So here I am in grad school, super excited, 22 years old. I'm taking classes, I'm teaching classes, I'm giving lectures, I'm volunteering, I'm working for the postdoc, I'm working for the senior grad student, I'm writing my thesis, and I'm learning these complicated laboratory techniques, confocal microscopy, immunohistochemistry. I'm working around the clock. And at first, I'm so excited that I don't really notice how much I'm working, and then I'm working all the time. I'm going to the lab at 6 a.m. when it's dark, and I'm leaving the lab at 7 p.m. and it's dark, because this is Wisconsin. And I start to not eat, I start to not sleep, because I just want to be perfect, right? I just really, really want to prove that I deserve to be here. There were only 3 people admitted in my class, and one of them came from Yale, so here I am, right? But I deserve to be here. I'm going to work, and I'm going to prove I deserve to be here. And the lab that I joined, it researches cocaine addiction and stress. And they have found some pretty similar findings, that the stress hormone cortisol, when it's released, it can actually set the stage for triggers of drug use to kind of come up to the forefront. When you're stressed, you're in this like state of constant alertness, such that cues that might otherwise have gone unnoticed can actually trigger you to crave when normally they wouldn't. So we're researching this, and it's fascinating, and I get published. I get published as a first-year student in the Journal of Neuroscience. 6th author, but hey, counts. Counts. And I am, once again, traveling and presenting my research, and everything's amazing, and I finally made it, and I'm doing the thing that I'm supposed to do, right? And who I was is just a memory in the past. And then it happens. Trauma. I went through a horrible assault experience, and I became what I was studying. I'm chronically stressed, as most graduate students are, and now I've gone through trauma. Trauma changes your brain chemistry. Trauma, it can make you more vulnerable, right, on a biological level. And this is something I study, this is something I know about, but it's not gonna apply to me. It's not going to apply to me because, you know, I deserve to be here and I'm not who I was. So I'm just going to work harder and I'm just going to do my best to try and not let it affect me. That's not how you deal with trauma. Spoiler alert. So I get a therapist and I start doing music again. Seriously, funny thing about music is that music is like magic too. If you hold up your fist like this and you put your thumb and your pinky to the side and pretend this is a brain, this part in here, this center part, is your limbic system. Pretend that's your limbic system right there. That's your amygdala. It's this part of your brain that processes emotion. And either one of these sides, your pinky and your thumb, this is your temporal lobe of your cortex. This is where your auditory processing takes place. There is a direct wired connection between your ears and your amygdala. And that's why music can wake people from comas, why it can remind an Alzheimer's patient who they are, where they were. Something about music and sound is directly wired into our memory. And so I use music as therapy to access the emotions that I was shoving as far deep as I could. And it kind of worked for a while, but the problem with chronic stress is it's chronic, so I didn't get to stop being in graduate school. Now I'm in my 2nd year. now I have to do my master's thesis. And so once again, I'm running around because I have to top myself. I was sixth author. Now I want to be third author so that I can be first author 2 years from now, right? And I'm pushing myself and I'm pushing myself and I'm pushing myself and I'm not sleeping and I'm not eating and my hair is turning gray. I'm 23. And I relapsed. And I tried to hide it because I didn't know what to do because I'm here and I deserve to be here and I'm not that person that I was. A few months go by and I have to give my outline for my master's thesis. So I go to my PI to do that, to give him my master's thesis, and I walk in and he blindsides me. And he says, you failed your final in neuroscience foundations. Whoa. And then he says, you know, because of that, we have to put you on academic probation and you have a choice that I need you to make right now. And I'm like, what? And he says, you can either stay and extend your stay and stay in this program, right, for another year, which would mean 6 years total, or you can go. If you stay, and I know you just put out an album, which is what he said, if you stay, I need you to give 200% to neuroscience. And I'm sitting there, no sleep for days, trying to remember everything that I've learned all the time and apply it in the right ways, in the right places, and trying not to mess up the research, frustrated that my experiments won't work. Apparently no one's experiments work at first. That's why you do it for so many years. And trying to keep it all together and trying to be perfect. And I'm like, that's a whole nother 100% than I've given you. Like, I have nothing more to give. I'm already spending my Christmas in the lab with the lab rats. The only difference between me and them is I'm on the other side of the cage. That's it. Like, I'm like, I can't. If I give you anything more, I won't have anything left of myself. And so I just probably should have taken a second to think about it. But I said, I think I'm done. And I got up and I walk into my office and I just sweep everything off my desk, all the data, all the notes, all the post-its of everything, the little vials with the brains in them, and probably shouldn't have kept that, but it's fine. And I just sweep it all into these garbage bags. And why does my stuff always end up in garbage bags? And just cramming it in there, and the graduate students finally look at me, and they really look at me. I take all my stuff, and I just run down 3 flights of stairs as fast as I can. I just run with my stuff, and I burst out the doors, and I get outside, and I'm on the sidewalk, and I look up, and it's day. It's day and the sky is blue, and I haven't been outside during the day when the sky is blue in months. And I'm free.
That was Anna Miller. Anna is a graduate in neuroscience and psychology from the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. When she's not being an academic scholar, she is a trilingual artist. In the Milwaukee music scene, she's better known as MWGLI, which I believe is pronounced Mowgli. Born in Bogota, Colombia, and raised in a Greek-American family, her music combines Latin soul and New Age hip-hop with moody, ethereal, and exotic soundscapes. During her time as a student at Marquette, she was published in the Journal of Neuroscience. She's now researching how we fight stress and the effects of drug addiction. The Story Glider is grateful for the support of the Tiffany & Co. Foundation and of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. The Story Glider is led by me, Artistic Director Aaron Barker, as well as Executive Director Liz Neely, with help from Deputy Director Nissa Greenberg, Operations Support Manager Lindsay Cooper, and the rest of our amazing team. The stories featured in today's podcast were from shows produced by Miriam Zaringhalem, Shane Hanlon, Nikisha Roberts-Washington, and Genesis Renji. The podcast is edited by our podcast team, including Zoe Saunders, Gwen Hogan, and Jun Chen. The theme music is by Ghost. Special thanks to Beer Baron and The Dandy for hosting these shows, and to Bethany Arts Community once again. Thank you so much for having us. Thanks for listening.